or irreversible damage. Remember that we were scared, what I talk about? So when you have signs of that, and you have lack of full scientific certainty, that should not be used as a reason for postponing measures to prevent environmental degradation. Basically, what they are saying is it's better to be safe than sorry, right? When you don't know what's going to happen because of the things you're doing today, then just don't do it, right? More regulation. Don't produce that. Don't do that, right? Or do this instead of doing that, right? So, like, for example, a very good example is the GMOs. You know, the genetic genetic modified food, you know. Monsanto is one of them. It's very well known. So we don't really know the effects of that in the health, right? It's a new technology, and it's innovation, and we crave innovation, right? Everybody is looking for the new thing, right? And we, in our society, believe that technology is going to give us the solutions to the problems, right? But when we don't know the effects of that new technology, what the precautionary principle is telling us is stop it. Don't do it. Because you don't know the damage, right? And then you can imagine all the discussion about that, especially in the organizations. When a company comes up with a new technology, like, for example, the geoengineering for climate change. Have you heard about that one? No? Well, it turns out that when they were studying these particulates in the atmosphere because of the ozone, they figured out that those particulates, when the sun comes, they reflect the sun. Right? So they don't let the sun go through. They reflect it. So when we have a lot of those particulates in the atmosphere, the temperature actually drops. So what they are saying is that why don't we just throw a bunch of those particulates in the atmosphere and then problem solve, right? And it sounds very cool, right? And it's innovation, right? But we don't really know the consequences of that, right? So the precautionary principle is very, very controversial. It has been used correctly in some places, and it also has been used incorrectly in some places, right? And when we come to the organization, to the company, it's even more complex. Because let's say that you come up with this new product, right? That produces, or this new way of producing, that has less energy, right? But then this material has something that you don't know exactly the effect of that because it's a nanomaterial or, you know, something there that you don't know exactly. And then you go and show it to your boss. Hey, look, I have this and it's very good and it's innovation and maybe I win the Nobel Prize for this and everything. And then your boss says, no, precautionary principle. Let's not do that. Do you really think he's going to do that? No. Right? So the question is, the precautionary principle is something that is given, but are they really using it in the companies? So is this rational? Is rational to use the precautionary principle? Wait, hold on. I am running out of battery. Just give me a sec. There you go. Okay. So now the question is, is it rational to use the precautionary principle for everything? Right? What do you think? First of all, do you know what rational is? What is rational? Tell me. You choose. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, logical, right? You are looking for the most rational way, we see the most optimal way, right? The lonesomest, the most profitable way, right? Right. That's what we understand for rationality in the neoclassical economics. That's what they understand for rationality. That's what they say, that we look for optimal solutions. We look for the maximum profit and utility. We know all the choices, right? And our brain doesn't have any limitations. We can calculate pretty much everything. Those pros and cons, we can do it, right? And then if you don't do it like that, you're not being rational. Right? That's what neoclassical economics is telling us, right? And what they say is like, if I give you 100 crowns or 50 crowns, which one do you want? Ikitan, you take the 100, right? That's the example they use, right? But, here's the but, that's only one way of seeing it. Because there are alternative rationalities, right? It is what we call our intuition, right? So, for example, Alkian, he's an Austrian economist. You should read him, he's very interesting if you're interested in economics. He says, economic entities evolve according to their survival, which not always is consistent with conventional economic norms of rationality. What he is saying is that what we care is about surviving, not necessarily profit maximization. Because sometimes, to survive, I need to give up some profit. That's what he's saying. And then he comes this other guy, this Coy Hayek, and he's like my favorite. I have read pretty much everything. If you, like, read him, if you have the chance. Maybe not now when you're doing all the exams, but one day, read him. It's very interesting. And what he says is that there is some rationality that we have in ourselves, that is embedded in ourselves, that we get from evolution, that we get from our culture, right? It's what they call intuition. When you make a decision, you know it's right, but you don't know why. Have you experienced that? A lot of people have experienced that, right? And you are not doing the pros and cons and doing all the calculations and, oh, no, this one is better than this one, because no, not always. Sometimes we just do this because it feels right. Magefølelse, intuition, right? So they come up with this alternative rationality, and they call it ecological rationality, right? And then ecological rationality refers to the emergent order in the practices, norms, and rules is emergent. Nobody's telling us what to do. It comes from us, right? We evolve with that. We learn it from our parents, from our grandparents, is implicit in us, right? And is the response to adaptation to the environment, right? So those intuitions, we learn it because something happened in the past that make us adapt to that, right? In contrast to the constructive rationality, which is the neoclassical understanding of rationality. that we measure, that we look for the maximization, we always look for the optimal, right? So the interesting here is that there is not only one way of understanding what rationality is. There are alternative ways of understanding what rationality is, right? And it doesn't mean that if you use your intuition, you're being stupid, which is some people try to say that, right? Like, for example, there is this psychologist, he's called Gigerenzer. He has run a lot of experiments to try to show this ecological rationality. And they give problems to people, very complex problems, and they solve them. And they don't know exactly why they solve them, but they do it. Or this other one that is called Vernon Smith. He won the Nobel Prize together with Kahneman. And he is interested in markets, right? And how markets find equilibrium, how do we find the price and everything. And then he figured out that a lot of people in these experiments he made, they figure out the equilibrium price without knowing how or why, right? And if you eliminate chance, because in a lot of these experiments there is a lot of variability just because chance, people just figure out things by themselves. And that's what we have pretty much have done these 3 million years we have been here, right? So don't let anybody tell you that because you're not following the profit maximization thing, you're stupid, right? That's my point of view, right? We have our own way of rationality. And actually, Hayek says that the individual knows best what is best for itself, right? So if the British vote out from the Brexit, are they stupid? A lot of people believe that. But maybe they are not. Maybe they are just adapting to a situation with the immigration, right? Yes? Uh-huh. Yes, that's a very good point. And very good that you brought it up. Because when I ask you what is rational, then you need to have a reference point, right? Rational to what? Compared to what, right? And that's what Kahneman has do, which is what you're saying, and what they call unbounded rationality. So they say we have limited capacity in our brain, right? And because of that limited capacity in our brain, we're not doing as logically as they say we should do, right? But exactly what you say, yes, you're being irrational if you compare me to that way of understanding rationality. But if you compare me to the way of adapting to the environment, I'm doing just fine, right? So the reference point here is very important. Rational to what? Right? And that's what this guy Gigerenzer is trying to do. And he's actually very interesting to read. He has a lot of books. There is one that is called Rationality for Mortals. Very easy to read and very interesting. And then he has another one that is called the last one. It's a tiny one. It's a paperback. It's a tiny one. It will come up later. But it's very interesting reading because it's kind of like another way of understanding how we think, right? Anyway, so if we compare them, the ecological rationality admits that we have a limited brain, that we look for suboptimal solutions, that we adapt to the environment, is bottom-up, is organic, nobody's telling us what to do. It observes, it formalizes, and it adapts, right? And it looks, and it's, we learn by trial and error, right? That's how we create that rationality, right? So people that have a lot of experience have a lot of intuition, right? On the other hand, we have the constructive rationality, which suggests that we have an unlimited capacity in our brain to make all those calculations, to compare the pros and cons, and to find the optimal solutions. We always look for profit maximization. We do not adapt. We always look for profit maximization. It's design, it's top down. So somebody's telling us what to do. It's formalized and predictive. We always know the results of everything. While in ecological rationality, we just don't know, we just adapt, right? We don't know what's going to happen, we adapt. In constructive rationality, the alternatives are given, right? So I give you 150, right? I give you the alternatives. But in ecological rationality, you look for the alternatives because you're adapting, right? In constructive rationality, you assume that you know exactly what is going to happen in the future, right? So my point is that in order to solve the sustainable development problem, we need to think different because we don't think the way they are telling us we should think. We adapt according to the time frame that we're looking at. We use different types of rationalities when we're trying to make decisions regarding sustainable development. So when I'm looking at the time frame in the short term, I might use the logical constructive rationality because I have the data. I know what is going to happen, right? But when I start moving a little bit further in the medium term, in the long term, I might use my intuition. I might not even care. In the long term, we just don't care. We're not going to be there, right? So who's going to take care of that? Evolution, right? So this is my theory. This is my hypothesis. This is what I want to test in my PhD. So what I have been talking in the last hour and a half is the theoretical construction of my hypothesis, right? So I just went and read a bunch of books, a bunch of papers, mix it up in my face, in my head, write some things, and then came up with this, right? So this is what I want to test because this is what I believe is the truth. Now, it's not the truth, but this is something I really want to figure out. I'm very curious about this. So how am I going to do that? Well, I'm going to test this hypothesis with laboratory experiments, right? And when you think about laboratory experiments, you probably expect that, right? But it looks pretty much like this, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create this little game in the computer that recreates a situation with a sustainable development problem, and then I'm going to ask people to play with that and solve the problem. And then I'm going to see how do they do it. So that's my plan. And if you want to participate, let me know, because I will need people to play with the game. So you have my email, and or I will probably send you some emails. I will use Anegrete as my gatekeeper. And I will probably run them February, March next year. So if I manage to get you excited about this and you want to participate, it will be very cool. Because then the more people, the better. Now, I want to show you something before we go. And it's called the ISDG model. Because one of the things I'm going to use for this is a system dynamics model, right? That's my background. I am a modeler. Not a model, but a modeler. So I am going to use something similar to this. This is something we use to plan policies for the countries. We have used it in Tanzania. We have used it in Senegal. And we are going to use it in Malawi. And what does it do? Well, it has the 17 sustainable development goals that I have been talking about. These are the ones that were designed last year. We can look at them very briefly. The first one is no poverty. So eliminate poverty in all its forms. It's not going to be hunger, zero hunger, good health, quality in the education, gender equality, clean water, affordable clean energy, decent work, infrastructure, reduce inequalities, sustainable cities, responsible consumption, climate action, life below water, life on the land, peace, justice, and then partnerships. So this is what they have agreed. Almost all the countries have agreed that they are going to work on these 17 areas in order to live a sustainable life, right? So that's what they believe a sustainable development should have, right? Now, the problem is, how do we do that, right? So now they say, by 2030, I am going to reduce poverty in Norway. Well, there is not that much poverty in Norway, right? So is there other places where we can work more, right? So maybe in infrastructure, here's something we can do something about it, right? Like, I suffer every time I have to drive here from Valdres, right? So what the governments are doing now, and I'm not talking only about the poor governments, but everybody. That's the beauty of the Sustainable Development Goals, that everybody is committed. It's not the rich countries telling the poor countries you have to do this. It's everybody saying, this is important. We need to do something about it, right? So, and we will see, Sweden is very active now. Norway is starting to walk up a little bit. So everybody's going to try to do something about this. Now, the problem is what to do, when, and how much we should invest in this, right? And this little tool help you to do that. So what we do is that we go to the governments, we sit with the ministers. When I say we, I mean me and an NGO that I work with in the United States. So we go there, we sit with the ministries, and we say, okay, how much money do you have? What are the main areas that you want to focus in? And what are the policies that you want to test? Right? So, for example, one of the policies is increase irrigation, right? With better technology, right? But how do you know the effect of that? So behind this interface, there is a system dynamics model that takes into account the environment, the society, and the economy. So you just put one of those policies there, you run the model 20 years, and you see the effect of that policy in health, education, GDP, everything, right? So let's say, for example, that we want to invest in industry, in infrastructure. So we click there and we see that there are two policies here already. One is to pave roads. This is the data from Tanzania. This model is from Tanzania. And then we have railways, right? So we can invest as a percentage of the GDP. So we say, okay, the government wants to invest, and you see that it's 3 years investment, right? So the government wants to invest 2% of the GDP for paved roads until the 2030, right? And then, wait, not 22. And then you say, but how much does that cost, right? So the cost today is this one, and you can increase the cost in the 2030, right? Then you can run it. You can call it SDG test, save. And then you have this. Does anything change? Do you see that now you have another line here? So the first line is the one that tells you how would it look like if you don't do anything according to that goal and the target in that goal. And then the blue line tells you how would it look like with the new intervention, right? And you see that there are not that many differences. So according to this, 2% in ROA paid doesn't make that much difference, right? So the idea with this is that governments play with these things, right, and discuss about it, and has a common, you can call it data. It's pretty good, the data that we have here, in order to discuss what policies to do, right? So I wanted to show you this because something similar is what I'm going to use in my experiments. I'm going to build a model that has an interface, and then the person that is going to play with the model is going to make decisions and see the effect of that decision and then make new decisions, right? Okay, so do you have any questions? Do you have anything you would like to add? Would you like to play with this thing? So if you would like to play, go to ISDGs, www.isdgs.org, and then you can download it and you can play with it. So now, just to make a little summary of what I have talked. I introduced you to sustainable development, or many of you already knew about that. We discussed about why sustainable development is important, right? And then I gave you a very brief view of the literature review I have made and how I believe that they are only concerned with the what's and the how's, but not the why's. And then we went a little bit more in detail about the why's, and we saw that there is this overshoot and collapse, and that we are scared as a humanity of that. And that's why we all agree that this is important, right? But then we start thinking about what is the future, according to what sustainable development says, that we need to look at the future. And then we see that the future can have many time frames, right? And then we see that the longer the time frame, the more difficult for us to think about it, right? And then we go in deep to what is actually to think about it. And then I introduce you to some concepts about rationality, about that there are different types of rationality, and we can group them in constructive rationality, which is the logical, optimal way of thinking, pros and cons, right? We know everything. And we have this other way of thinking that is the ecological rationality, that is evolutionary, that is our intuition, and that not necessarily means that it's wrong. It just depends on where do you use it, because it's an adaptation to changes in the environment. Then I take those two things and I put it together and I say that in order to think in the long term in sustainable development, we need to understand this as that we use different types of rationality, and then I am critical to the precautionary principle as the only way of solving the problem, right? And then I tell you that that's my hypothesis that I want to test, okay? That was like a brief summary of what we talked about. Now, any more questions, comments? No? Okay. Then we're finished. Thank you very much. This was fun. Thank you.